Wise Studies presents The History and Practices of Traditional Hatha Yoga with Dr. James Mallinson. At Wise Studies, we are committed to illuminating the texts and teachings of the world's great contemplative traditions. In this series, James Mallinson, one of the world's foremost experts on classical Hatha Yoga, gives us an in-depth look at the texts, teachings, and practitioners that make up this rich tradition. In this first session, Jim discusses the prehistory that forms the foundations of Hatha Yoga.
Hello and welcome to session one of this course, which is an introduction to Hatha Yoga. Now, what is Hatha Yoga? This is a question I ask myself often. I'm Jim Mallinson. I work at SOAS, the erstwhile School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, and I'm currently leading a five-year research project into the history and practices of Hatha Yoga. So yes, I ask myself often, what is Hatha Yoga? And the answer is not really that clear. I have to work from some kind of definition, and the place I start is in the textual definitions of Hatha Yoga. So from the Sanskrit texts, which codify its practices, and they were written down. There's a sort of first wave of them from about the 11th to 15th centuries CE. And in those texts, Hatha Yoga is sometimes defined, or otherwise its characteristics are implicit, and its defining features appear to be certain practices, in particular techniques known as mudras. So in the first text that codifies the practices of Hatha Yoga and calls them that as well, is an important distinction, because there's an earlier text which I'll talk about in a later session, called the Amrita Siddhi, which is actually the first text to teach the practices of Hatha Yoga, but it doesn't mention Hatha Yoga once. And so the first text which does teach Hatha Yoga and name all its practices is a text called the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, which means something like the yoga treatise according to Dattatreya. And in that text, the defining or the distinguishing characteristics of Hatha Yoga are nine of these practices called mudras. Now, they're all physical techniques for manipulating the body's vital energies. And I'll go into more detail about them in a later session. Right now, it's just Hatha Yoga. What does it mean? That's what I'm going to focus on. In a slightly later text, or perhaps contemporaneous with the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, but a text called the Amaravaga Prabodha, which means something like the awakening of all the immortals. In that, Hatha is defined, so the Hatha variety of yoga practice is defined as that which is, the Sanskrit phrase is Prabhanjana Vidhana Rataha, so that which is intent upon or focused upon the management or control of the breath. So that's a key feature of it in these early definition, and that's then expanded in the same text. It also says that Hatha is divided into two kinds according to whether the focus is on the breath or bindu. Now, bindu, again, I'll talk about that in more detail in a later session, but bindu is the vital principle in the yogi. And yeah, something I should make clear early on in these sessions is that the texts I'm dealing with are almost always, well, they are always written from the perspective of a male practitioner, and the prescriptions and teachings are aimed at men. We can infer from them that certain places that women were doing some of these practices and were involved in the practice of Hatha Yoga, but the texts are never geared towards its practice by women. Okay, so in the yogic physiology taught within these texts, the bindu, which is analogous to semen, is the kind of key, or one of the key vital substances which needs to be cultivated and protected by the yogi. So yes, in this Amaravaga Prabodha text, Hatha Yoga is identified as yoga in which the control of the breath and bindu is paramount. And then later on in that text, it teaches various of these mudras, these techniques which are used for controlling the breath and bindu. And then in the 15th century, there's a text called the Hatha Pradipika. It's often known as the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, but I would argue that that is that's not really the correct name, because that's never how it's referred to in manuscript colophons. And actually, as a little aside, that raises an interesting point. I mean, I talk about Hatha Yoga, and we often talk about different methods of yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga, you know, different, whether it's the yoga of knowledge or the yoga of devotion and so forth. But in those compounds, as they're understood in Sanskrit, the usual way of understanding them is that the first member, so Hatha or Jnana for knowledge or Bhakti for devotion, is the means by which yoga is attained. Because there's a sort of ambiguity in Sanskrit between whether yoga is the goal or the method. So actually, generally, when we see the compound Hatha Yoga in text, it means yoga, as in the goal, being achieved by the Hatha methods. So the text will often talk about just Hatha. In fact, more often than not, they'll talk about Hatha rather than Hatha Yoga. And then they'll examine the methods of Hatha. And Hatha is a very common Sanskrit word meaning force or sort of stubbornness or insistence. And I'll come back to that later on, because we need to bear that meaning in mind as well to understand the origins of where Hatha Yoga has come from. And that's what this session will be devoted to. But in the Hatha Pradipika, so that the name of that text means something like the light on Hatha or the lamp. A Pradipika can mean a little lamp. The lamp on Hatha, so something that casts light on what Hatha is. And in that text, the defining feature of Hatha practice, well, it actually gives a sequence of the stages of Hatha practice. And the first is asana, so posture. The second is kumbhaka, breath retention. The third of these practices called mudras, which I've already mentioned, these various physical techniques for controlling the vital energies. And the fourth is nada anusandhana, or in short, nada. And that means something like focusing on the internal sound, so the sounds that arise internally in the course of yoga practice. And so those are seen as the four stages in the practice of Hatha. Now, of those four, the first three are pretty much unique to Hatha Yoga. And we, in earlier treatments of yoga, so in texts predating the 11th century and so forth, we do get mentions of asana, but they are always simple or relatively simple seated postures for meditation. We also get instructions on pranayama, breath control. But again, that's always a relatively simple method of alternate nostril breathing, generally used for purification. But in the Hatha corpus, we get these more complex asanas, and we get these more complex methods of breathing in and out and holding the breath. So I think it's those the distinctive features. So the complex asanas, the complex breath control methods, and these mudras, these techniques of manipulating the vital energies. The fourth of, as mentioned in the Hatha Pradipika, the nada, listening to the internal sound, is actually found in earlier texts, in particular texts of the tantric tradition. So we can't really see it as a distinguishing feature of Hatha Yoga, even though it's a very important method of achieving samadhi, so absorption in the self is how it's normally understood. Okay, so that's a brief overview of how Hatha is understood in the early Hatha corpus. There's a later definition, which is very commonly cited in secondary sources, in books on the history of yoga and so forth. And that's from a text called the Yoga Bija, which has a verse which reads in Sanskrit, Hakarena tu suryo sau ta karen enduruchyate. Surya Chandramasur Yogad Hatha Yoga Bhidhiyate. So, and the meaning of that is by the syllable ha is meant the sun, by the syllable ta is meant the moon. And Hatha Yoga is so called because it is the union, i.e. the yoga, of the sun and the moon. Now, this appears in this text called the Yoga Bija, probably 14th, maybe 15th century. And that seems to me to be in some way trying to override the actual meaning of the word hatha. The actual meaning of hatha being force or sort of stubbornness. And because the way I understand, and I'll talk a bit more about this later on though, is that the texts of Hatha Yoga were written for a kind of general audience, you know, for you and me, the regular yoga practitioner, not for the ascetics, so the kind of world renouncers, the classical sort of Indian holy men, who are always seen as the practitioners of yoga par excellence within the Indian tradition. And they are renowned, and I'll talk more about this as well shortly, for their sort of extreme ascetic practices. And that really is the first and obvious sense of the word hatha, kind of something that's forceful, something that's difficult. But that, as the practices get translated for a less ascetic, a less renunciatory audience, that aspect of it gets slowly elided. But at the same time, one must remember that the texts that we have that tell us about the history of Hatha Yoga are really just a very small window onto the history of the tradition. And we have to use all the other sources we can, really, to try and reconstruct that history. And in particular, something I found particularly useful in my studies of these traditions is ethnographic, so anthropological research, because we do find that a lot of the culture that surrounds yoga practice continues to exist to this day. So it's very useful to spend time amongst traditional ascetic practitioners of Hatha Yoga as a means of understanding the historical context as well, because one can assume that in some respects it's still being transmitted and practiced as it always has been. So I do quite a lot of that. It's good fun as well, of course, but it's very informative. And the sort of the meaning of hatha, the kind of the lived meaning of hatha as opposed to the textual meaning of hatha, was brought home to me at a Kumbh Mela festival last year, so in 2015 in Nasik, when I was walking down to the river with a bunch of Hindu holy men, Hindu yogis, to bathe on one of the main bathing days. And we passed a sign that had been put up by the local municipal council, a big kind of poster, and it said in Hindi, well, the Hindi went to read, Sadhu Ninda Mahapape Isliye Jatadhari Hatha Yogi Nagna Adi Sadhuon Ka Upahas Na Uraye. Now that means something like, being rude to holy men is a great sin, so do not laugh at holy men who have dreadlocks, a Jatadhari, who are Hatha Yogis, who are naked and so forth. Okay, so you know, this is, you know, if Hatha Yoga is this great tradition that's taught in all these ancient hoary Sanskrit texts, as they like to say in India, at the same time, why would people laugh at Hatha Yogis? And that's because the reason why people might laugh at Hatha Yogis is because the vernacular usage of the term, you know, so the Hindi usage of the term, generally refers to these ascetics who do these really extreme, hardcore practices, such as, you know, holding an arm up in the air for 12 years and so forth, or never sitting down. Now, the texts of Hatha Yoga, as I mentioned, first appear from about the 11th century AD, that is, CE. But that's just the text, okay? Now, it seems pretty clear that the practices would have been going on for much longer than that. And that's what I'm going to look into now, you know, the sort of pre-history of Hatha Yoga. So it first gets codified 11th to 14th centuries or so forth. But what, you know, what evidence do we have? What are the likely forerunners of those practices? And who was doing them? This is what I want to look at now. Now, as I mentioned, the defining practices of Hatha Yoga are its mudras, so these special techniques, which I'll go into more detail about in a later session, and the asanas and special methods of breath control. Now, I won't really look into the special methods of breath control. Actually, there's not much evidence for the specific techniques of Hatha yoga, you know, the some more complex methods of inhalation and exhalation, prior to the writing down of the corpus. Although we know for sure that ascetics were practicing breath control, we have very little on beyond the simple techniques of alternate nostril breathing and then holding the breath for long periods. But I will talk a little bit about that. But the other two distinguishing practices of Hatha yoga, so asana practice and mudra, we do have kind of oblique, fleeting references to in various texts and travelers' reports. So perhaps the oldest of those is the Pali canon, so the kind of canonical text of the Buddhist tradition. Now, the Buddha probably lived in the 5th or 4th century BC. The texts as we have it, so the texts of the Pali canon, can't be dated to much before the 1st century BC, but they almost certainly contain information directly drawn from direct experience of the Buddha's life. Now, the Buddha lived in sort of the far north of what's now central India, in the region across the border between Nepal and India. So that area was then known as Magadha. Now, it seems to be, and the great scholar, the great exponent of this theory is a scholar called Johannes Bronckhorst, who wrote a book published in 2007, called Greater Magadha. And he puts forward this pretty convincing theory. I think that it can be tweaked a bit, but that it was in that region that much of many of the central principles of what later became understood as Hinduism and other Indian religions developed. So these are principles such as karma, so the notion that your actions have an effect on your subsequent existence, and then the related concept of samsara, so transmigration, in which the soul passes through various, you know, thousands or millions, as it's normally understood, of incarnations before hopefully finally becoming liberated. So this is a third kind of connected concept, the notion of liberation, nirvana, mukti, however that's understood, as liberation from the cycle of transmigration. Now, these are concepts that aren't found in the earlier Hindu texts, apart from the Upanishads. We first see them appearing in the Upanishads, and that's the Upanishads are perhaps also related to this, the ascetic tradition, so the world-renouncing traditions that developed in the region of Greater Magadha. And so we find the teachings of the Upanishads, which are associated with sort of ascetic Brahmins or Hindus. But then there's two other major world religions developed in the same area. That's Buddhism and Jainism. So Buddhism is the religion associated with the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, and Jainism with the Jinnas. So these are the sort of conquering masters. They're said to be 24. The last one who is the main proponent of the Jain tradition, Mahavira, he was probably more or less contemporaneous with the Buddha, so sometime in the 5th or 4th century BC. There are also other traditions. Most best known is one called the Arjivakas. Again, we don't have much in the way of information on them, and most of it has to be inferred from the texts of other schools, or almost perhaps all of it. I don't think there are any actual direct writings that have come directly from Arjivakas themselves, but we find a lot of references to them in the Pali canon of the Buddhists. And these ascetics, so all these various traditions, have a kind of generic term, the Shramana, and that means striving. In fact, in some ways, you know, it's kind of related to the concept of Hatha. Shramana means putting in effort. It means striving towards something. Now, in this sort of melting pot, this region of Magadha, where all these various ascetic traditions were, they were it seems that they were all trying out various different techniques of confronting this newly formulated problem. The big problem, you know, the problem that some of these traditions saw as perpetuating existence and or the existence that's understood as suffering is karma itself. So karma is a Sanskrit word, root form karman, meaning action, simple as that. So it's related to the English word create, creation, the same root. But karma, yeah, is seen as creating an effect which will then cause further existence down the line, further suffering. And so you want to stop karma. This is how some of these ascetics formulated their response to this problem, was by thinking that you had to just completely stop karma. And not only did you need to stop it, you needed to get rid of past karma, because that would keeps having its effect. And so it's the Jains in particular who formulate their approach to this problem in terms of extreme asceticism. So they think that by suffering hardship in some way, they will burn up their past karma. It's seen as, you know, it's kind of a bit like a penance in the Christian tradition. Although it's not, karma is not necessarily seen as sinful, just a bad thing, because it perpetuates existence. So by doing some kind of extreme penance, the ascetic will burn up his past karma. And also, those penances are generally associated, or generally involve, remaining extremely still and effectively doing nothing. So you're not creating any more karma as well. And within the Jain tradition, that manifested in and still manifests in. It still happens today, not very often, but when it does happen, it's reported in the Indian press and so forth, in the a form of suicide called Salekhana. So the Jain ascetic will literally just sit down and fast until death, and that's seen as a sort of fairly guaranteed way of achieving enlightenment. And they would adopt, these ascetics, some of them would adopt difficult physical postures, and that would be seen again as a way of burning up past karma. And so the Buddha, he wanders around, and there's various stories that he tells in the Pali Canon, and he reports on what the other ascetics in this kind of really vibrant milieu were doing at the time. And he, of course, also famously tries some of these things. So there, in the Pali Canon, but the Buddha reports that he tried holding his breath, you know, for as long as he could, and he goes into some detail about quite how unpleasant that was, and how he feels that he's, you know, being roasted over hot coals because he held his breath for so long. He fasts for ages. He becomes extremely thin and emaciated, and again he feels this great heat build up inside him, unbearable heat. And yes, as an aside, this is an ancient motif which remains current in Indian religious traditions, that asceticism is associated with heat. The word is tapas. The root tap means to create heat. But the Buddha, and he also, yeah, interestingly, when he when he's trying holding his breath, he adopts various bodily postures. You know, he sits down cross-legged, but also he says that he pushes his tongue back against the top of his and the rear of his mouth, and that actually is then echoed later on in one of the Hatha Yogic Mudras, the Khechari Mudra, in which the tongue is turned back and in fact flicked up above the soft palate. Also, the Buddha talks of ascetics adopting squatting postures, Ukkutika Padhana, and these are also echoed in the Jain tradition. In some texts, Mahavira, the great and last of the Jain saints, he's said to have attained enlightenment in this squatting position, in which it appears that it's in some way quite uncomfortable, and the suggestion is that perhaps pressure is being put on the perineum, again in the manner of some of the later Hatha Yogic Mudras. Similarly, the Buddha mentions ascetics who are practicing the bat penance, the Vaguli Vrata, or in Sanskrit, Valguli Vrata, which literally means the observance, the Vrata of the bat. And that is explained in commentaries as being a practice in which the ascetic, the holy man, hangs upside down from a tree like a bat. And this is our sort of first mention of an inverted yoga posture. And that, again, is one of the mudras taught in the later Hatha Yoga texts. And in some commentaries, it is said that, I mean, the texts, the earliest descriptions of these inversions in the Hatha Yogic texts don't say how they're to be done. They just say that you must turn upside down. I'll go into more detail about the mechanics behind that later on. But then in some later commentaries, that's understood as either being a headstand or a shoulder stand, or indeed hanging upside down from a tree. You know, hanging. They generally use rope or some sort of cloth to tie the feet, so that you're then hanging upside down from a tree in the manner of the back penance. So we see it within the Pali canon, these forerunners of what we later see formalized in the Hatha Yogic texts as the methods of Hatha Yoga. And similarly with the postures, we do get an early report from the classical Greek tradition, in fact. So Alexander the Great visited India in the latter half of the 4th century BC. Now, we don't have any, you know, direct eyewitness accounts from exactly then, but we do have the history of Strabo, which again, I think scholars date to approximately the same time as the Pali canon, at least its sort of codification or writing down. And he mentions a couple of meetings. The first one, Alexander didn't actually meet these ascetics. There's a sort of classic standoff, which is still, you know, still the way things go today, is that holy men, you know, see themselves as the top of the pile, and they won't go and visit other people. People have to come to them, and vice versa with the Emperor Alexander. You know, he wouldn't go and see these ascetics. So, but he did send some of his emissaries to go and check them out, and they reported that they came across, and I'm quoting here from Faulkner's translation of Strabo's Geography, which was published in 1859. And they came across 15 men standing in different postures, sitting or lying down naked, who continued in these positions until the evening and then returned to the city. The most difficult thing to endure was the heat of the sun, which was so powerful that no one else could endure without pain to walk on the ground at midday with bare feet. So you see here we have this combination of difficult physical postures and also it being exposed to the hot sun, which again is mirrored in, or is continued in traditions found to this day. India's Hindu ascetic traditions still engage in such practices. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But there's one other example from Strabo's Geography, when actually some ascetics did come. You know, Alexander and his army were camped somewhere in what now is Pakistan, Punjab. And the story reported goes as follows, and it's talking about two of these ascetics. The word used in Greek is gymnosophos, so it literally means a sort of naked philosopher. And the two of them, and here now I start the quote, they came up to Alexander's table and took their meals standing, and they gave an example of their fortitude by retiring to a neighbouring spot where the elder, falling on the ground supine, endured the sun and the rain, which had now set in, it being the commencement of spring. The other stood on one leg with a piece of wood 3 cubits in length raised in both hands. When one leg was fatigued, he changed to support the other, and thus continued the whole day. So again, you know, we know from these examples, so from the Pali canon of the Buddhists, from these reports of Alexander the Great's travels in India, and also from certain Jain texts, from the Jain tradition, that in this very early period, you know, more than 1,000 years before any of these practices were actually codified in Sanskrit texts, that they were being undertaken. And so it's not just physical methods or the, you know, physical postures that were part of this whole tradition. As I mentioned earlier, there's fasting, there's holding the breath for long periods, as reported by the Buddha. There's also techniques, particularly well-known one that crops up regularly, is sitting surrounded by fire in the midday sun. So we already heard about these ascetics that Alexander's entourage came across, who would expose themselves to the heat of the day. A very ancient tapas, or tapasya, as it's called in Sanskrit and Hindi, is sitting surrounded by fire. Classically, it's five fires, okay? And you would, the ascetic would do this in the burning sun. Now, the reason I'm talking about this as well is because it's the same groups of ascetics today who are renowned for being the practitioners of Hatha Yoga par excellence, who also still undertake all these tough austerities, these tough tapasyas. So within the Ramanandi tradition of ascetics, for example, which is the biggest order of Hindu holy men today, a fairly common practice is what's called dhuni tap. So tap from this root tap to get hot or to practice austerities, and dhuni means a smoking fire. Now this is a course undertaken by quite a large proportion of the ascetic wing of the Ramanandis. It's an 18-year course with 6 3-year stages, and they practice it for the hot months, so from mid-February or so to June every year, and they will go out and sit in the midday sun, well, for a couple of hours each day, surrounded by burning, smouldering cow dung fires, and they'll meditate under the burning sun. In the first stage, they make five piles of fire, and then that increases to, it goes 5, 7, 12, then 84, and then an unbroken ring. And then in the final 3-year stage of the 18-year course, they put a burning pot on their heads. Now, this is a fairly extreme technique, of course. And they also, but quite a few of them will also, at the end of each session of this dhuni tap, they will do some yogic postures. And they'll be doing breath control throughout it. They'll be doing pranayama methods, but then they'll also do some asanas and so forth at the end. So, you know, the point I'm trying to make here is this seems to be the origin of these hatha practices. It's amongst these really quite hardcore ascetics. And just to go back to the point I made earlier, that the word hatha, even today, is associated with these ascetics who do these really extreme techniques. So the texts of Hatha Yoga were written down in the 11th century. They started then. But as I've pointed out, you know, we can go back nearly 1,500 years and see evidence of the practices being carried out. And also once the texts were written down, the practices continue to be carried out by these ascetic traditions, perhaps in ways, you know, not exactly the same as what's written down in the text. We have to understand the text, as I mentioned earlier, as kind of translating the methods of these ascetics for a wider audience. So now I just want to look for the remainder of this session to look into, again, these kind of underground currents, you know, these non-textual evidence for these practices and these traditions up to the present day. Now, one of the very first texts to detail Hatha yogic postures is actually, again, it doesn't use the word Hatha yoga, and it's a Jain text from about 1200 by Hemachandra, a great polymath, great scholar called Hemachandra, who wrote a yoga shastra. And in the tradition of lots of great Indian scholars, he wrote a kind of root text and then an auto-commentary. He wrote a commentary on his own text, a bit like how the Patanjali's yoga shastra is now understood. You know, the Bhashya, the commentary, is seen as having been compiled or composed at the same time as the sutras themselves. So Hemachandra wrote this very voluminous text on yoga with a very extensive commentary. Now, the text itself has been studied quite a bit, but the commentary's hardly been looked at, and I've been looking at it recently, and it has some very interesting analysis or descriptions of various complex asanas, and it's one of our earliest treatments of this. And it also coincides with a discovery I recently made at a very small town in Gujarat in western India, a place called Daboy, where there's a beautifully decorated and fortified gate from about the same time. So about the gate has been dated to 1220, and on it we find the earliest depictions of complex yoga postures. And by that I mean, you know, postures other than seated positions for meditation. Now within in Hemachandra's text, he gives various names. You know, he talks about inverted lotus postures and headstands and other difficult positions. There's one one that puzzled me for a while. He talks about the headstand, and he gives it two names. So one, pay attention to, because it's going to come up later, called Kapali, okay, and the other one is Duryodhana Asana. Now that really puzzled me for a while, because Duryodhana is one of the key figures of the Mahabharata, but I couldn't understand why he would be associated with doing a headstand. Now, a student I met in Oxford, and I was talking, I gave a lecture about this, and he pointed out to me a passage from a later commentary on the Mahabharata, which explains how Duryodhana, so the in there's a famous episode in the Mahabharata when Duryodhana gets Draupadi, who is the queen, the wife of the five heroes, the five Pandavas, the five heroes of the Mahabharata, and he insults her by making him sit on her lap. Now Bhima, who's the kind of the mighty warrior, the strongest of all the five Pandavas, he vows that he will smash Duryodhana's thigh. And now the explanation of how he accomplishes this without, so that it just as we have in the West, you know, it's bad form in a fight to hit someone below the belt. Bhima had a problem because he wasn't, you know, it would have been very bad form to smash Duryodhana's thigh. But Duryodhana, during their battle, during their fight in the main battle of the Mahabharata war, he sort of pulls a fast move on Bhima. He thinks he's pulling a fast move and goes upside down. He's doing some kind of ninja move. And as a result, whilst he's doing that, Bhima then smashes his thigh. Okay, so that's how it's explained. So this is why the headstand is understood as Duryodhana Asana. Although that name seems to have fallen out of practice, but Kapali didn't. Now, the reason I find this mention of Kapali, the name Kapali Asana, which comes from Kapala, skull, so it's not that surprising a name, but it doesn't crop up in any Sanskrit texts at all until 600 or 700 years later in a text called the Jogpradipika, I think it is the first subsequent mention in the 18th century. But we also have another mention in the 18th century from the life story of another one of these sort of hardcore extreme Hatha ascetics, a guy called Puran Puri, who has been of great interest to me since I first heard about him. Now he lived in the second half of the 18th century, and we know about him. Well, I first found out about him because a precis, so an abridgment of his own account of his life, was published in Asiatic Researches, which is sort of the first academic journal to do with the study of India, the first, you know, Western influence, which was set up by William Jones and others in Calcutta at the end of the 18th century. Now, in one of the very first editions of Asiatic Researches, we have this précis of his life, and his life's fascinating for many reasons. But a few of the things mentioned in that précis, which was put together by Jonathan Duncan, who was the collector, he was a sort of, you know, Raj official in Benares at the end of the 18th century. He makes a few tantalizing references to what was in the original full account. And one of them is about when this guy Puran Puri, this ascetic, as a young man, he's probably a teenager, he goes to a big festival at Allahabad in northern India. Now, it's it'd be a forerunner of the Kumbh Melas. It's not actually, they're not called Kumbh Melas then, that comes later on. Burhan Puri, he's taken initiation as a yogi, as an ascetic at this point. And he goes, he's sort of decided he wants to undertake some hardcore practice. It's not clear, so it's not clear from the account what the Hindi word is, but we can imagine it's probably tapas or yoga, something related. And he goes off to this festival, and he says that he met this bunch of ascetics, you know, all these gurus at the Mela, and they told him about the 18 Brahma mudras, okay, and that he chose from these 18, he chose the Urdhva Bahu practice, which means putting your arms up in the air. And he put both his arms up in the air, and he kept them up in the air for the rest of his life, a good sort of 50 years. And he has this amazing life story, which I'll talk a bit more about in a minute. But the tantalizing detail there was these 18 Brahma mudras, and we're not told what the other ones are in the abridgment by Jonathan Duncan. It mentions these 18 Brahma mudras, but we're not told what they are, you know, so it's tantalizing detail. I was very keen to find out what the other 17 were. And by a great stroke of luck, when I was researching a lecture I was going to give on this subject, I came across Burhan Puri's original statement. His personal life story had actually been published anonymously in a magazine called the European Magazine in 1810, and thanks to Google Books, I kind of stumbled across it. And in that, we do get the full list of the 18 Brahma mudras. Now, the reason I'm talking about them is because amongst those 18, there are some methods which we would clearly associate with yoga practice, you know, that they are not obviously these hardcore tapasyas, like holding your arm up in the air for 12 years or longer or whatever. And there are other similar things in the description among the 18. So there's the first one in the list is Tardeshwari. Nowadays it's known as Kardeshwari, but it means standing up, you know, never sitting down. And this is something, again, current for among ascetics today, and it's usually done for 12 years. There's another one, Akash Muni, which is explained as fixing one's regard towards heaven and never looking down towards the earth. And we see this represented in Mughal miniatures. In fact, a lot of these tapasyas we see represented in Mughal art. Although this one, the Akash Muni, the always looking up towards heaven, sort of perplexed me and other art historians for a while, until we came across this account by Burhan Puri. Because you see these guys sitting on the ground, but leaning right backwards with their heads over a big pillow so that they're constantly looking up at the sky. It looks extremely uncomfortable. There are various others. There's one, Dhumrapana, which also is the word for the Hindi Sanskrit word for smoking, but it's not smoking. It's sort of smoking. It's a bit like the bat penance. They would hang upside down from a tree over a fire, swinging backwards and forth. But amongst these kind of extreme practices, we also find number 8 of the 18 Brahma mudras is Chaudasi Asan, which means 84 postures or 84 yoga postures. So different postures in sitting, such as continuing, this is how it's explained in the text, different postures in sitting, such as continuing several hours with the feet on the neck or under the arms, after which the members are returned to their natural positions. And then Kapali, which is a headstand, effectively placing a betel nut on the ground and standing with the head on the nut and the feet in the air. So if you remember, you know, this is what Hemachandra also used this word Kapali for the headstand 700 or 600 years earlier. So this sort of, you know, that gap indicates that we have a, you know, there would have been a living tradition, a living oral tradition of ascetic practice, which we don't find codified in text, but there's a continuity there of at least 600 years. And there's a couple of other things among the 18. There's another one, Chaurangi Asan, number 14, is a particular posture. So it means the pose of Chaurangi. Chaurangi is one of the ascetics or saints associated with the Nath tradition, which I'll talk about in a subsequent session. And that is described as to sit down many hours on the knees, bringing the right foot over the left shoulder and the left over the right, with the arms in like manner over the back, so as to hold the toes of the feet on both sides in the hands, which I think is probably a bound lotus posture. So this is, you know, what this shows is that within these ascetic traditions, the practices that we understand as yoga and the practices that we understand as kind of extreme asceticism, standing up for years on end, whatever, were all closely associated. And that's something we see throughout the textual tradition as well, from a fairly early period. So in the Mahabharata, for example, which I mentioned earlier, in the context of the Duryodhana asana, it's the same ascetics who are said to practice tapas who also practice yoga. And the methods are, you know, part and parcel of the same, the same idea. They have the same results. Although tapas is generally associated with going for kind of specific aims, specific goals. And I'll talk a bit more about that in the context of Hatha Yoga later on as well. So, but as it's formalized, yoga is the aim of yoga is normally either liberation or special powers, special rewards, special results. And within the literary tradition, tapasyas, these extreme ascetic techniques, self-mortifications, are undertaken with normally with a specific end in mind. So, you know, these great kings or great sages in the Mahabharata and the other epic stories will do something like stand up for 12 years on end in order that the god Shiva will present them with a great weapon or something like that. But the whole, there's this whole complex of ascetic practice and yoga that combines together to create this kind of power within the person of the ascetic. And the techniques of Hatha Yoga, as analyzed in the text, as explained in the text, are often geared towards cultivating this power, this same energy that's produced by tapas, but also holding on to it. So celibacy is key to the practices of these ascetics as well. It's seen as the fact that they are celibate and continent and never shed their semen is central to the powers that they are said to accumulate through the practice. So often the gods will feel threatened by the power that's being attained by one of these ascetics. And one of the ways they'll try and stop that is they'll send, you know, a beautiful heavenly nymph to try and seduce them. Because if the nymph is successful and the ascetic then sheds his semen, you know, stops his celibacy, then all his power goes away. And we can understand the techniques of Hatha Yoga as actually being, you know, more specific physical techniques of A, maintaining celibacy, and B, channeling it into positive results within the body. So when I started studying the texts of Hatha Yoga in detail, so that was for my PhD about 20 years ago, it was with a view, the reason I undertook the study of the texts of Hatha Yoga was because I wanted to use my Sanskrit training to understand better the ascetic traditions with which I'd spent time in India. Now, at the time, I didn't really register the fact, I didn't understand the significance, but you know, the first texts that presented themselves to me were these texts of Hatha Yoga. So I produced a critical edition of a text called the Khetri Vidya, which is about a key Hatha Yogic practice called Khetri Mudra. But what I realize now is, in fact, it's the texts on Hatha Yoga that are they're the only Sanskrit texts of any relevance to these ascetic traditions. Nothing else that they do is actually written down. It's all passed down orally. So all these extreme ascetic practices, these Brahma mudras, pretty much all of them, you can't find anything out anything about them in text. There's no text which teaches you how to do the fire penance of sitting surrounded by five fires in the burning summer sun. There's no text which teaches you, you know, how to stand up for 12 years on end or hold your arms up in the air or do any of these other techniques, which is why it was so exciting to come across the treatment of the Brahma Mudras by Puran Puri. But it also then made me realize, so these things, you know, almost all of the ascetic lifestyle is passed on orally. How to live the life of one of these full-on hatha yogis is all passed on by word of mouth from guru to disciple, apart from the methods of hatha yoga. They're the only ones that we find in Sanskrit texts. And that, I think, is because at some point it was decided that they would be written down in order to disseminate them to a wider audience. So the texts of Hatha Yoga and the practices taught therein, they are the one thing, the one sort of gift from these ascetic traditions for which India has always been so famous, for which the world has always been fascinated by, that they're the one thing that they have given to everyone else, you know, that they haven't kept secret and locked up within their own oral initiatory traditions. And I will talk more about the actual techniques and the texts in which they're taught in subsequent sessions.